This is Publishing Talks, a podcast about the book industry. I'm David Wilk, your host. Today I'm talking to Lee Clancher. He's the, he's a writer, an editor, a photographer of some note, and also the founder and publisher of Octane Press. How are you, Lee?
I'm doing great. Really appreciate being on with you here, David.
Well, thanks for doing this. You know, as a publisher who works hard for a living, I know you're busy, so I appreciate your taking the time.
No problem. There's always plenty to do, but I always love to talk about my business. So it's one of my joys.
Well, on your website, you have one of the great, I think, one of the great stories about who you are and what your business is about. I really like it. And, it's kind of inspiring, really. Maybe you could talk a little, people can go and read it for themselves on your website, I know, but maybe you could kind of just talk about a little bit how the company started and how maybe go back a little further, talk about your career prior to being a publisher and how that got you to being a publisher.
Absolutely. I think it all started with me in books somewhere. In fact, I got to add it to that post. My mom has a picture of me in a basket. I think I was 4 years old reading a book. And since about that time, I've been in my happiest place, left to myself with a book. So a love of books came really early. Shortly after came a love of motorcycles. I fell in love with them when I was about 6 or 7 and 11, started riding. So long story short, I studied science writing is kind of where I ended up. I studied engineering for a while, and that was fairly ill-fated. And then happily went into writing. And the idea was I was going to become a science writer, but I sort of stumbled onto this writing about cars and motorcycles. And I also kind of stumbled on photography about the same time in college. So, that led to a career. I worked for a book publisher called Motorbooks. They do books about cars and motorcycles, and that was a good fit. And I also did a lot of writing and photography on the side. I was always a very active writer. And I did that for quite a few years, and it fit the things I loved. But I was looking for something a little more, and in 2002, I was on an assignment for a magazine called Dirt Rider. And at that time, I was doing their adventure travel. So I would go to exotic places and take a camera and a motorcycle and a pencil and travel and write stories about it, which was about as good as it got in my journalism career, to be honest. We were in Baja at the time, and we got lost. We got lost on kind of an uncharted road. We had to find gas. We were in a western side of Baja, which there is absolutely no roads. There are lots of little trails, but there's no formal roads. There's no signs. And it's very easy to get mixed up. We got mixed up. We didn't have enough fuel. We followed a truck. This guy came by with a truck, the only guy we saw all day on the road. And he didn't speak English, and I don't speak much Spanish, a little bit. We told him kind of our problem, and he figured out we needed gas. So we followed him to this tiny little town, bought enough gas to get to our next destination, and went on. We got so mixed up by this whole experience. When we arrived at the next destination, we were supposed to stay overnight. We thought we were only half done with the day, and this was, I think it was around lunchtime. We got in or 1 o'clock. So we rode another about 80 miles that day, which on a really torturous off-road trail that went across the continent and over a mountain range. Very, very difficult terrain, long day. By the time we got in, Laredo was our final destination, which is on the east side of Baja. And by the time we got in, it was dark, or just getting dark. There was kind of that glow. And we came over this mountain pass, and you could see the Sierra Cortez below us, and that side of it is really beautiful blue-green. The sun was down, but there was some sunlight coming onto that water, and it was absolutely gorgeous. I took a picture and kind of had a moment. It was something really special. I'm not sure exactly what happened at that moment, but the next morning I woke up and I said, hey, this is what I was born to do. So from that moment on, I was determined to found my own company and spend my life telling stories rather than spending my life working for somebody. So that moment, there's another story there, but that moment led to the foundation of Octane Press.
Yeah, no, it's one of those, that's a great life-changing story, you know, where you have these, it's like a vision in a way, you know, it's like not everybody gets to have that experience, I think.
I you know, I consider myself extremely fortunate for, you know, that I get to do what I love to do and that that happened and pushed me in that direction. And I still, I mean, it's a tough one to explain, but I definitely do still to this day feel like when I'm out, you know, able to be out in the world, taking pictures, recording something, talking to somebody, have an interesting story to communicate, that's really, really why I do what I do.
So you say, you know, one of the things you mentioned in the story about Octane Press is that after you were freelancing and you figured out that the world was changing and it was becoming more difficult for you to, you know, make a living as a freelancer, but in a sort of interesting irony, easier to be a publisher in some ways. So you started pretty much on a shoestring with nothing. Is that right?
That is absolutely right. And the times definitely worked out in my favor and my background worked out in my favor. I'd been an acquisitions editor and an editorial director. And that really prepares you well to the business of books. Company I was at was mid-sized. We were very involved and understood how books worked. As an acquisitions editor, as I expect some of your audience understands, you have to do all the financial projections and understand when you go in and present your book to the publication board, you have to say, hey, here's why this book's going to succeed, so you understand the market, and here's the financials. You have to do a P&L and understand it. So because of that, I really understood the book business quite well. And as you say, I was seeing, you know, I quit in 2006, and in 2007, things at the magazine and the book publishers changed dramatically. The amount of money you could get for an advance, the amount of money and expenses the magazines had, all that was going in the toilet. So here I was, I'd spent since, you know, 2002, I'd been working to build this freelance business, and it was going away. I was looking at a way of life that I felt like was what I was kind of born to do and I'd invested a lot of time in, was going to disappear. So I also, at that time when I left, several people had approached me about starting traditional presses using Long Run. I had three different people that were pretty serious about it. We did a lot of financial projections and looked at it and thought about it. And a lot of it was more financial risk than I was comfortable with. I'm pretty risk averse, I think, especially for an entrepreneur. But so I'd done enough that when I realized that print on demand was alive and well, and a number of detail about that made it profitable, I realized we could start a publishing company with nothing. And I felt like if I started a publishing company and I was patient and we just invested that money, that eventually I could be in a position where, you know, I wouldn't have to rely on the magazines to have enough budget and the magazines not to fire the editor that liked me. You know, that I went through that. I think any freelance contributor would understand that. You have somebody, you have a great working relationship, it's all good, and that person either moves up or gets moved out, and the new person decides they want all new people, and you're out.
Yep, I've been there.
So I felt like, yeah, I think it's a pretty familiar story. So, you know, all the book publishing too has changed so much that it was, you know, you really had to be a top level, you know, you had to be a best-selling author, I think, to make it through that time and be able to have any modicum of supporting yourself.
So, but you made, I think you made a key decision that I think is really, really stands out. And that is, well, maybe you may, I think you made two key decisions. You probably made others that I'm not thinking about, but one is that you decided to sell direct to the reader, direct to consumer.
Yep.
And the other is that you really focused on I would say the books, the subjects of your books are books that you are personally passionate about. And the one thing, the one side, the, you know, selling direct to consumer is kind of, that's different from what most trade publishers do. And, but the selling, you know, the content side, doing books that you really care about, that you are already involved with and passionate about, subjects that you're interested in, that kind of takes you back to the way publishing was a long, long time ago. So it's kind of interesting that, you know, contrast those two elements. You know, one is kind of a new way for publisher. Well, nothing's new because in the old days, publishers sold direct to consumer too. But, you know, in the world that we know, most publishers are not focused on the reader. They're focused on the supply chain that gets books to the reader. And maybe you could talk a little bit about that, you know, that decision, and then how have you really done that with Octane Press? You know, I mean, you don't have to give away any secrets if, you know, I certainly am not asking you to do that, but just, you know, if you can talk about your strategies and goals over these past several years that have led to success, that would be great.
You bet. And I'll tell you, when you say there's nothing new, I'm sort of convinced that's the case. I think all I have that's new is a mashup, if you will. I've got a variety of different things going on. But the newness, you know, you always learn from where you've been. One of the things I learned really well was my time at Motor Books. That company was founded by a British guy who was here in the 60s, and he couldn't get good books about British sports cars. So in his garage, he started importing books from UK and other European countries and sold them direct to customers. And he had, in fact, at that company, when I was there at least, on the wall was his first brochure. It was just a little hand mimeographed brochure that he would mail out to people. And that's how he founded that company. And as long as he was there, for sure, that company's changed tremendously. Now it's a very trade-focused company. And it's owned by a very trade-focused company, and they're very good at what they do. But the way he founded it was finding these people and selling direct to them. So, you know, my early days of book publishing, I was around that business. I understood that business. That said, I don't think it really hit home until Christmas of 2009. We had a book that was a UK-only book we brought to the U.S. called Lois and the Loose. It had been in the U.S., but it was out of print. We put it back in print. And the New York Times did a piece about it. The automotive editor always really liked our stuff and would give us some mentions. And at the time, our website was pretty simple. I think we sold just through a PayPal buy tool. And my buddy and I at the time, who was working with me on that particular project, spent most of Christmas packaging books and taking them out of the post office and shipping them to direct people who bought direct. You know, and at the time it wasn't a whole lot of money we made, but at the time it was a lot of money for us. The company was just getting off the ground. So that was a very visceral lesson that, you know, when you sell direct, boom, it's there. You know, it's good margin and it's right in your pocket, and it doesn't have to be big numbers to be a difference. So I think that combined with my background at Motor Books and my understanding of the world we live in. I've always been a big computer geek, and I certainly understand that with the internet you can reach direct consumers in a way that was never possible even when I was at Motor Books. Those core days were the 90s, and you used catalogs and other things. The web is much easier, much faster, much more direct, so kind of all those forces came together and made me realize that selling to direct to consumer was important.
So, but do you sell only direct to consumer? Do you also sell through other channels now?
No, we're actually a very balanced company now. We sell Amazon is strong for us. And I have a lot to say about that at some point. We also sell very well. We have a great retailer network. We've built up a retailer network, and I think we have, it's more than 500. I want to say it's more than 1,000 now retailers that buy from us direct. And we also sell through the bookstores, through Ingram and Baker and Taylor. We're in YTP Library Services. We have a distributor overseas. So we're very broad-based now. And I love selling online. Last year it was our number one customer was sales online, but that doesn't mean by any means, I think that was 30% of our revenue somewhere in there. So we have a nice broad base. And I think honestly, given as rapidly as things are changing, I think that's important. I mean,
protection.
I would have no problem. Yeah, exactly. Well, and who knows how it's going to shift, right?
Right.
Who knows? If I could be 90% online, I'd love that. But being where we are and where we're at, I like being broad. I think it's a better bet. And I think selling books, you know, every venue your book is in is also sort of another promotion venue. It means, you know, every store you're in, that means a store you got to face.
Right. It's face out in a store is advertising. It's
exactly.
valuable.
Exactly. And as you know, you got to hit them 2, 3, 4 times before somebody picks up your books. So all that I think is important. One interesting side note too, to go back to what you said about enthusiast stuff. And that was when I started this business, that was what I knew and where I'd been. And I was just like, hey, this is the business I've been in. This is the business I understand. I've got, 15 years of experience here. This is where I need to be. I think we will broaden beyond that. We've experimented with a couple things, and there's a couple things that are, I think promising that will work. But the transportation part of it, yes, I'm a gearhead. I love motorcycles. I love cars. I've spent a lot of time around horsepower. I also happen to love bicycles. I'm a mechanical guy, so that's important. It means I understand my readers. It means I don't have to rely exclusively on focus groups and feedback to understand how to satisfy the people that read our books. I think that's still important. You never know everything, but I think the fact that I at least am akin to them and I'm following what I love is important. It also means I just naturally love the books. So all of that works. That also worked when I talk about my retailers and our direct customers. They find us. Because, we've got this thing, and it's a narrow little thing. And when you put the word out there in however, social media, chat rooms, informal talk, publications, all this, all of a sudden, a lot of these retailers, especially our overseas retailers, they found us. They read about us in, some little magazine that covers a niche topic. And they're like, hey, I know my people here are going to want it. So somewhat ironically, that focus has helped us with our channels and our sales in a way that I didn't really expect or anticipate.
Oh, that does make sense. I mean, there are, it is a channel. It's an area of interest. So it supports a number of retailers as well. Now, that's interesting. You sort of cover some, it's all transportation, as you say, but tractors are very different than motorcycles. So, it's like the people, I wonder if the same people buy, that different people are interested in your tractor books than are interested in your motorcycle books for the most part. Would you think that's
very
true?
Much. That is true. And I've actually segmented, you can look at our website and see I've segmented our authors into, our readers, into 6 or 8 different areas. And when you say tractors and motorcycles, yes, they're two very different groups. We see a little crossover on occasion. We'll be at a motorcycle event and someone will also be into tractors, but they're two pretty radically different groups. And even certainly within motorcycles, there's a massive amount of segmentation as well.
Oh, that's for sure. That is true.
Look at adventure travelers versus Harley-Davidson people. I mean, it's two very different groups.
Right. Well, so I was going to ask you about that. You sort of touched on it, that do you go to a lot of events where you are face-to-face with the people that are buying your books?
We go to some. In the tractor segment, which is one of our biggest ones, they have a big show. We're actually gearing up for that right now. And that's held June of every year in different places in the Midwest. And we go there and we have a big presence. We have a big booth. We have now I think a half dozen or so authors, myself included, who do appearances and signings. And that for us is a big deal. That show draws about 25,000 people. So it's a significant group. We haven't done as much in motorcycles. We do occasional things, and a number of our authors have presence. Shows is something I'm very interested in doing more. We have to be pretty careful about our bandwidth. There's only so much we can do with a smaller staff. So,
yeah, those are time consuming too. I mean, you have to go, you have to plan ahead, you have to bring everything back. It's a lot of work.
You are correct. It is a lot of work, and but it also, when the event is right, and you're in front of that group, you really become intimate with that group. It's also kind of a living laboratory. I mean, you're talking to your readers, and that I would have to say, one way or another, is I think something that has been amiss in the book publishing industry, and I think we're fortunate in that we're in this little niche, and you're kind of forced to do it. But that intimacy with your readers, I think, is really important right now. I think going forward will be more and more important.
No, I agree. I think that's actually, the industry is recognizing it maybe a little bit in the sense that Book Expo has added the day or 2 days to the show to call it a book con and bring readers in to meet with publishers, to see authors. And it's a bit more like you might experience at a Comic Con or actually at your tractor event, or, like if you're going to Hershey for the, for the annual huge thing that goes on there. That's a place where, that is, as you said, that's where your audience is, the people that care the most about what you're doing. And, they're fans. They really want to be part. They want to be part of what you're doing, and you want to be part of what they're doing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
And I think that actually, it's hard for a general trade publisher because they can't get the depth of fandom that you would get at an event for tractors or an event for fire engines or, maybe a baseball convention, all those things that we think of as places where people go, they really care deeply about a subject. General publishers don't focus on any one particular area, so it's harder for them to participate in those kinds of events.
Absolutely. I agree entirely. I mean, I've been watching very closely what's been going on with BookCon, and I'm very interested because I love it. I think it's the right idea. But that's absolutely the puzzle is, yes, you have people who are just enthusiasts for books. There is that group, but I think that's a fairly small group. You could narrow it to, literary nonfiction. You can get groups around that. But it's not like these other groups that we're dealing with. So, right.
Although, what I think has happened at BookCon is they're getting, it is segmenting on its own, kind of interestingly, that what they're attracting heavily are young or teenage girls and boys, mostly girls. It's a really interesting demographic, and it actually is hopeful. It makes you feel good because if you've got kids coming to a book event and they are just, they're fans to the core. They love the books. They love the author. They want to meet everybody involved. And that's what could be better,
That's awesome. That's absolutely, absolutely. So I have to say, I'm not one of those that believes the book is going to die. I do believe the form might change, but, I think essentially, call it a long literary form, will at least last our lifetimes, and young people will still have that. I mean, there's something special about a book that just is ingrained in our culture that I don't see it changing, that will draw people like these kids that are fans. It's great.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, there is the concern, and I read about this I actually read something about it today that, you know, the worry that you have is that in the highly connected kind of internet focused world where as you know, you can put books in front of people, as you were talking about, in many more ways than we were ever able to do. And it's great because you can reach people who might not otherwise have known about you or your books or the kinds of things you're doing. You know, that the virality of knowledge being transferred between people is really powerful. But at the same time, books are in a world where it's easy for other forms of entertainment to interfere, you know, to break the concentration that people have. You know, to read a book, you have to spend some time, and the internet is so prone to short bursts of information and quick changes and interruption, essentially, that I think that's, you know, it's a fair concern that and it may lead to what you just suggested, that it just may change the way books are read and the way books are created.
Yeah, and I think you could compare what you're talking to say, let's say People Magazine and Esquire, right? People Magazine is all about bite size. I'm trying to use a nice word, but it's bite-sized bits of information. And say the old Esquire or New Yorker, being another great example, is all about absorbing a longer piece. It's my feeling, at least, that those trends won't change, and you're still going to have people that want to sit down and dig in and get something long and substantive and really learn about it, and others that are going to want to just breeze over and know, you know, the news about celebrities in a bite-sized fashion. So I'd like to, at least in the world I'm sitting in, I'd like to believe that those things may change slowly over time, and we might see less long pieces, and, you know, maybe a substantive piece becomes 2,000 to 5,000 words instead of 5 to 10, and a bite-sized piece becomes 25 to 50 words instead of 50 to 100. But I think those trends will stay. Again, as you pointed out, the big question is, where are people going to be reading these different things? I mean, take a 10,000 word magazine piece and try put it in today's world. I mean, that could be a book you paid 50 cents for. It could be a piece on a website. It could be a PDF somebody ripped off and sent to you. Who knows? So it's interesting.
Now, all of your books are, I mean, for the most part, your books are illustrated, correct? I mean, I know not all of them are, but mostly you do illustrated books.
Mostly we do. We do have a small number of narrative books that have been good successes and good books, and that gave us some eye-opening stats. I'm going to go off on a narrative tangent here, but one of the books we did that really blew my mind, we did a book called In the Red, and it was in 2011. It was early. The author had written a book called Driver Number 8. Only back up, the author was the publicist for Dale Earnhardt Jr., who was a very popular NASCAR driver. The author's name is Jade Gers. He also is a pretty fine journalist. And all that time, he was with Dale for 8 years. He kept copious notes. And when Dale said something interesting, he wrote it down. He had some recordings. He had tons and tons of daily notes of his interactions with Dale Jr., which he spoke to Dale about when he took the job, and they had agreed. So the two of them did a book called Driver Number 8 back in the late 90s. And it was a New York Times bestseller, terrific success. Jade wanted to do a follow-up, and the mainstream publishers wouldn't touch it. So he and I ended up connecting through a friend and doing the book In the Red, which was about Dale Earnhardt's year, the year his father died, very traumatic year. Interesting book. The most fascinating thing about that book, which was kind of our first commercial success, we didn't hit the New York Times bestseller list, but we did do very well with it, despite the entire book industry telling us that NASCAR books were doom and gloom at that time, was that EPUBs outsold the print 2-1, and it eventually became 3-1. And I was blown away. I did not see that coming in any way. the thing that I've thought about a lot, and we've seen this consistently with motorsports, it's an EPUB sell very well to a motorsports audience. If you think about NASCAR and you think about EPUB, it makes sense.
Sure.
Because NASCAR is the ultimate consumer audience. You know, if you put a tide on the side of your car, studies have shown that the fans of that driver will buy Tide. And EPUBs, talk about the easiest consumable book in the planet. You just open up your computer and boom, there it is. So, but anyway, that whole side of narratives to me was completely fascinating.
No, it is interesting. So where do you come down? This is a subject I've had lots of conversations about with different people in publishing. For the illustrated books, are you doing e-versions of those? And if so, what's your experience in terms of consumers' interest in those books? Are they, do you find that with the illustrated books, they're more interested in the artifact, the print book, or have EPUBs made some penetration in your market share?
At this point in Illustrated, they have not made a big penetration. And frankly, we didn't even touch them on our bigger, more elaborate books. Anything Illustrated, a fundamental belief I have is that because of the changes in the industry, it's more important than ever to make the book high quality. So when you get a book, I think a little more than, say, 10 or 15 years ago, today a book is something special. It's something beautiful, something crafted, something we use really fine papers, we use the best bindings, we use everything to make sure that that product, that book in your hand gives you a tactile experience you can't get elsewhere.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So, I think with the illustrated book, it's just the digital, you're just not going to get that experience yet.
Right.
Now, that said, I believe that will change, as we all, I think anybody who's watching knows. So up to this point, we really haven't done much. We tried some EPUBs with our kids line. We thought we might get some traction in the schools. We are getting some interest from schools and using that. In fact, there's one in particular that is looking at, using it school-wide, or actually I think it's district-wide. It's a large number of EPUBs they would use. And we're really interested. I believe that's an area where it would make life better for the teachers, because these books are being used as lesson plans. So I'm fascinated to see what happens there. But those EPUBs have commercially been a dud. We've priced them low, we've pushed them, and they just don't sell. I think parents want to read to their kids they want to take a physical book and do it and sit in the room and page through it.
And your experience is confirmed by many other publishers who are in the same area. You know, children's books, mostly print still. Illustrated books, by far, mostly print.
Yeah, and I keep looking. We have an illustrated book called The Build, and that book is kind of a hybrid. It's a 7.5-inch high by about 5.5 inches wide, 6.5, I'm sorry. So it's not quite an illustrated book, and it's not a narrative book. We deliberately designed it so it would go to EPUB nicely. It is beautiful to look at. There's gorgeous pictures. But the text is kind of smaller chunks. It's all laid out in one column. So it made a lovely EPUB, and we used a small kind of craft producer to make a very nice EPUB of it. That audience is international. They're the Custom Motorcycle Group, which is a very young, high-tech kind of group. So, and that came out maybe a month ago, not even now, a few weeks ago. And we've had some sales. It's not significant yet. It is higher than our other EPUBs. So, and I think that kind of EPUB, given our platforms, given what's available, Kindle is so limited, might work. Because you could sit and read that book. The pictures aren't quite as nice. The experience isn't quite as rich. But, people are going to read this book, and certainly for reading, EPUB is a valid choice, let's put it that way.
So we didn't get a chance to talk very much about your work as a photographer. I didn't want to neglect that completely. I've seen some of your photographs, and I think you are really good. Some of your photographs remind me even of, you know, the black and white photographs of, you know, people engaged in industrial work. I thought spectacular. And of course, your color work is really good too. But do you find now that you're publishing and you spend a lot of time in your work as a publisher, do you have time to do photography?
I still do. And I'm a bit of a, how do I put it? I think there's a lot of photographers that shoot every day. I don't shoot as often, and that's true, and I don't have the time to shoot as often. But it works. Let's just say that. I'm not sure I can characterize it better, but it works. I shoot probably at least once a month, and I still shoot for myself at home on a pretty regular basis. And I am able to maintain that. And ironically, although I was trained as a writer and I'm probably a more experienced, knowledgeable writer than photographer. I'm much better known for my photography than my writing. So yeah, I still do have time, and I've got a couple projects that I'm working on that I'm real excited about. And it's still a real important part of my focus. So.
Well, I'm glad you still get to do that work, because it's really good. How about writing though? Is that because, you know, writing takes a lot of time and effort.
Writing takes a lot of time, and I definitely backed down on that. I used to do quite a bit of magazine writing and pretty much all of the writing for some of my books. Now I tend to collaborate with writers and pick and choose pretty carefully the stories that I tell. So, I do find time for that, and those two things are why I'm in this business, and I don't intend to let that go. And I sort of take it as I'm going to have to work 14 or 16 hour days if I want to be a writer and a photographer, because to make room for that, I have a lot of other things I also have to do. And that's, you know, this work is a really important part of my life. So that's okay.
So do you own any tractors?
I do not. tractors are something I love from a historical perspective and their significance. They aren't something that I'm as deeply involved in. I do have an old truck and a motorcycle and a bunch of bicycles, and those are all things that they're activities I'm passionate about. Tractors are much more. We had one, my grandparents' farm, we had one. And, oh, it was certainly fun to go puddle around in the woods and haul wood and do those things, but that's almost as much about being with my family and being out in the woods as it is the machine.
No, I was just giving you a little, you know, a chance to talk about tractors, but you do have motorcycles, yeah, right? You're still riding.
I do. I actually only have one. I had a bunch, and when I moved to Austin here in 2008, and I decided to see if I could get my. I mostly like off road riding is what I really love, and I switched to bicycling just because I'm kind of tired of my recreation being burning gas. As I got older, I got a little more. Ecologically conscious, I guess is the right word. And that's been great. I ride a bicycle three or four times a week at a minimum. My motorcycle, I don't get out as much anymore, but I still do have one. And I certainly on a motorcycle, I think it's the best way to travel a new place you can imagine. You're part of the environment. When you pull up to a gas pump in a motorcycle, people come and ask you where you're from and talk to you. And that means you learn so much more about the area because you're just sort of, in a lot of different ways, you're just sort of part of your environment.
Oh, yeah, because, so, you know, you're not in an enclosed pod.
Exactly. You can smell it and touch it and talk to people. So,
right.
Yeah. But I still love it in that front.
Well, that's good. Well, it's been a pleasure to talk to you. I think probably there are many other things we could have touched on, but I'm glad we had a chance to talk. And I think highly of Octane Press. I think I admire what you've done. I think that's really, it's been a great accomplishment. I assume you have many more books in you and lots more publishing to do.
Absolutely, David. That's true. And thanks so much for taking the time. I certainly love talking about this business and kind of my odd little path to it. So really appreciate you taking the time and reaching out. I'm looking forward to seeing the piece on the air.
Thanks a lot. This has been Publishing Talks, a podcast about the book industry. I'm David Wilk, your host. I've been talking to Lee Clancher. He's the founder of Octane Press and also, as you know now, an author and photographer.